From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Cannes Film Festival is over. We talk with one critic about the movies that matter to her. Then, documentary director David Modigliani embedded with Beto O'Rourke during his Texas Senate race, and he found similarities between grassroots politics and his own work as an indie filmmaker.
Documentary film is a lot like a campaign in the sense that you're always sort of building the plane while you're flying it. There is something entrepreneurial, I think, in independent filmmaking that is similar to a campaign.
And a look at the lasting appeal of the song California Dreamin'. All that coming up on The Frame. The Cannes Film Festival wrapped up this past weekend. The awards are out and the reviews are in. Antonio Banderas won Best Actor for Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory. The first award given to a Black female director went to Mady Diop for her film Atlantiques. And one of the most talked about films, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, failed to win a single prize. We connected with Alyssa Wilkinson over Skype to get her take. She's a film reporter at Vox.
The Palme d'Or winner, which is the top prize at Cannes, was Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. Bong is known for making films that are very much about class warfare, and this one is especially about that. It's kind of a literalized metaphor about class warfare in Korea. There was a film called Baccarat from Brazil, and that one's about poor people in a village being targeted by wealthy people for sport, and they're trying to fight them off. There was a film called Atlantiques, which was the first film actually from a Black woman to be in the main competition at Cannes. And that one's really about young Africans who are fighting back against a wealthy developer who's not paying them for their work. So it was really a festival full of films about vulnerable people trying to figure out ways that they could gain agency.
There are a couple very high-profile Hollywood films that were showing at the Cannes Film Festival. One of them is Rocket Man, the movie about Elton John, directed by Dexter Fletcher, who was the uncredited director who finished Bohemian Rhapsody, and then Quentin Tarantino's film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. They seem like very different movies. What was your take on Rocket Man and Quentin Tarantino's latest film?
I actually enjoyed both of these films, I think, more than I was expecting to going in. I wasn't really sure what to expect about Rocket Man. I had seen some early footage that made it look like it was going to be quite a different sort of movie from Bohemian Rhapsody, which is kind of a straight-ahead biopic. This one has more fantastical elements, which I think really suit the music of Elton John. I think he has a lot of problems as a film. It's somewhat formulaic still in the way it tells Elton John's story. But it's fun, and I think that the people who see it who are fans of Elton John's music, which in a sense is most people, really will come away with a better idea of where he came from and what he's all about. I also have never been a huge fan of Tarantino's movies, most of them anyhow, but I thought Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was maybe one of his stronger films as a piece of filmmaking. It's really about the golden age of Hollywood and about Tarantino's nostalgia for an age that, you know, has passed.
I'm Sharon Tate. I'm in the movie.
You're in this?
That's me. I play Miss Carlson, the Klutz. Oh!
And it's also an intriguing take on the summer of 69 in LA, while also telling a story that I think is pretty poignant in a time when Hollywood is changing again.
Like a lot of film festivals, there's always going to be polarizing movies at Cannes, and the Cannes audiences typically are very vocal or loud in expressing their opinions. People walk out early and thump their chairs, and then there are people who give standing ovations. Were there some films that you saw where the audience was incredibly polarized, and maybe people were reacting in a way that was very different from how you were watching a film?
Yeah, I mean, I normally see films in press screenings, and press can sometimes be the more vocal group of people. They're very opinionated, of course. One of the films I think that had the most polarized opinions was Terrence Malick's new film, A Hidden Life, which I really liked.
Where are the kids?
Inside.
It's about an Austrian farmer who became a conscientious objector during World War II because he wouldn't swear an oath of loyalty to Hitler. There were definitely very divergent opinions about whether this was a story Malick should have been telling, whether he told it well. But, you know, that's the fun part of going to a festival with such a wide range of critics at it, is that everyone has very different opinions, and you're suddenly kind of in a conversation with people who have experienced the film in a completely different way from you, even though you were sitting in the same room watching it.
I want to ask about a couple other films. One stars Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. It is called The Lighthouse. It sounds like an interesting film. How would you describe it?
So this film is from the director of The Witch, Robert Eggers. And The Witch was a horror film that really kind of startled people when they saw it. It felt like a very different sort of horror film for a lot of people. And The Lighthouse, I don't know if I would describe it as horror or comedy or both or neither, or I'm not really sure, but it's a film about two guys on this island tending to a lighthouse. It's set in kind of vaguely maybe the 19th or 18th century. They speak in very mannered dialogue. It's shot in black and white and an Academy ratio, so it looks square. And it's sort of like the story of two men driving each other insane. And this is a pretty wild film, I have to say. You can get like little bits of German expressionism at times. You get hints of like old school sailor movies. The two of them are just having a ball. And I'm really excited for this one to make it to the U.S. I think it's one that people will be polarized over again, but it is not like anything I've seen before.
The opening night film, The Dead Don't Die, was a film about zombies that apparently were launched because of fracking. Does it feel as if all of these films, documentaries and narrative films together, were they pointing fingers at what's wrong in the world? Were they offering solutions or really just kind of documenting the struggles that people have?
All of the problems that each of the films brings up is a human problem, like maybe even something that's fixable, whether it's policies, economic systems that favor, you know, big corporations over workers, or whether it's environmental problems, which comes up many times. And so I don't know how many solutions are being offered, but maybe continuing to point at the problem and yell about it helps people understand that it really is a problem that could have long-term effects, but also could have solutions.
Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic at Vox.com. Alyssa, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a documentary filmmaker embeds with a long shot candidate who loses and is now running for president. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. At last check, there are 23 people running to be the Democratic nominee for president, and I'm not even going to pretend that I can name them all. But one of the candidates is probably best known for a race that he lost. That's Beto O'Rourke. He tried to unseat Texas's Ted Cruz in the U.S. Senate midterms a year ago. Filmmaker David Modigliani was embedded with O'Rourke on that campaign, and he followed the Texas congressman as he went from an unknown long shot to a national media sensation. Modigliani first met Beto O'Rourke in an unexpected place.
It was a baseball game in Austin, Texas. I'm a founding member of the Texas Playboys Baseball Club, a sandlot team we've got. And we sometimes will have friends that form teams in other cities and come play us. And so in April of 2017, Los Diablitos de El Paso showed up at the field, and they had this lanky center fielder with a name that I hadn't heard before who happened to be a U.S. congressman, and he had announced that he was running for Senate about 6 weeks prior. So I was playing first base, and he got a single, and we had a chance to chat a little bit there. You know, and I had been really since the 2016 election feeling how much we dehumanize each other through politics and how much that causes people to just sort of tune out and drop out of the process. And I was looking for a story that might rehumanize it or make it feel more accessible. And so in the seventh inning stretch, Beto jumped up on a hay bale and, you know, brushed his sweaty locks aside in his dirty uniform. And it was pretty clear, like, oh, this guy, you know, looks like a movie star. But it was actually the type of campaign that he described that he was going to run, that he was going to really take some risks and try some new stuff, you know, to go to every county in Texas, to only take money from other human beings, not corporations or PACs. That felt as a storyteller, you know, something that would be really exciting to follow. And of course, he had this epic foil in Ted Cruz as well.
And what was your pitch to him? What was the film that you said you wanted to make, and what did it require of him? And I think even equally important, his family to give to you.
My first film, Crawford, was about the town of Crawford, Texas, which George W. Bush moved to about 6 months before he announced his candidacy in 2000. And I had showed up in Crawford as a kid that grew up in the Northeast with some real two-dimensional views, kind of stereotypical views about what small-town Texas might be, and wound up kind of falling in love with the people in Crawford as these very warm, generous, great storytellers. You know, we might have disagreed politically, but I really connected with them as human beings. So when I had breakfast with Beto, I told him how excited I was that he was going to go to these, you know, very conservative, deep red parts of Texas to show up and have the conversation in person, to treat people that might disagree with him politically, you know, just like other human beings. And that part of it was really where I looked to connect with him and told him that I thought what he was doing was unique and special, and that, you know, there would be media coverage and there would be postmortems, but that I really wanted to tell that fly on the wall immersive experience of the campaign that he was getting to run. And there's a lot of moments in this film where he does not come off particularly well. You see him in moments of real frustration. We developed a real trust, and that allowed us to capture some really intimate moments in the film.
I'm wondering what kind of autonomy you required from the Beto O'Rourke campaign to not have them approve or disapprove anything you were filming.
It was really important to me from the outset that this would be a fully independent, you know, creatively, financially, fully independent project, and that Beto and his team would not have access to any of the footage and would not have approval rights over the final cut of the film. And I think it's a real testament to Beto, to his wife Amy, to their team. You know, you can talk about running a transparent campaign, but to really let us into, you know, behind the scenes of the machinations of the controlled chaos of the campaign itself, as well as into some of their more personal moments through this odyssey, it is a testament to them walking the walk as far as sort of opening up the experience of running for office.
It's hard enough to be a parent where both people in the household have jobs and you're trying to raise kids. I want to play one clip, and it's really about the toll that the campaign takes on the family. And this is the younger son, Henry, trying to call his dad to say hello.
Your call has been forwarded to a system.
Hi, Daddy. I hope you can call me soon. I love you. Bye.
It was powerful to watch Beto and his family try to maintain their bond and their relationship through the travails and struggles and challenges of this campaign. And I think that a lot of working parents out there that travel, that try to balance pursuing their dreams and delivering the value they have to bring into the world, to balance that with you know, their parenting and their presence in the lives of their kids. And I think it's a unique lens into politics and the experience of public service.
In some ways, I'm reminded of like what it means to be an independent filmmaker, that you are doing something against all odds, against all reason, with very few resources. And I'm wondering if you kind of saw yourself and see other people who are working in documentaries or independent film reflected in what you saw in this campaign of what the sacrifice means to tell a story that you think needs to be told.
Documentary film is a lot like a campaign in the sense that you're always sort of building the plane while you're flying it. There is something entrepreneurial, I think, in independent filmmaking that is similar to a campaign. You're building a team, you're building support, and you are trying to express and communicate a vision and get people to buy into that.
We're talking with David Modigliani. He's the director and producer of the documentary Running with Beto. You embed with Beto and his family and his staff from the very beginning almost of the Senate campaign. And as the campaign goes on and Beto starts doing better and better, and then there's the whole Colin Kaepernick conversation.
While the eyes of this country are watching these games, they take a knee to bring our attention and our focus to this problem to ensure that we fix it. That is why they are doing it. And I can think of
a lot of people start hanging out with Beto. And that means a lot more cameras, a lot more media. What does that mean in terms of your own access?
When that clip went viral and he became a national sensation in what felt like overnight, this national media descended into Texas, into these tiny towns, and international media. There were crews from South Korea and Australia and Japan showing up in, you know, Goliad, Texas, population 400. We were excited that, you know, the sort of star of our film was gaining this national following. But at the same time, to your point, the folks we were following were suddenly besieged by the volume of press, the amount of asks and attention that they were getting, and the well-wishers began to make it challenging for us. And we started to get sort of lumped in with the rest of the media. There's kind of a physical response to that attention, which is to sort of, you know, circle the wagons and turn inward. And that's what Beto and the team started to do. And so with about 2 months left in the campaign, I had to have a sort of come to Jesus moment where I wrote to Beto and Amy and the senior staff, and I said, hey, you know, I think we have the chance to make something really special that captures the legacy of what you guys are doing. And, you know, I said, there's a few key moments that we really need. And a total credit to them, you know, allowing me to be in the green room during the big debate with Ted Cruz and allowing us to be in the kitchen with them after, you know, on election night, after this campaign that they have fought for 2 years to try to win has gone south for them.
I need to figure out what to do with all my shit in D.C.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
They really did deliver on their commitment of that access to me. But because of that attention, we did almost lose it.
Your film premiered at South by Southwest on March 9th, and Beto O'Rourke actually took the stage with you there. On March 13th, the day before he announced his presidential run, Vanity Fair published a profile that got, let's just say, a mixed reaction. And then he declares, when you think about the role that this film serves in the narrative of Beto O'Rourke, what do you think it represents? And what role does the film play in our understanding, not only Beto O'Rourke, but also politics and politics in Texas?
I think part of what the film will show is that positions that have become default for some of these other presidential contenders really originated with Beto in Texas, particularly not taking PAC money, which has quickly become a default position, but which Beto did, you know, just 18 months, 2 years ago. And by the end, he raised $80 million, which was more than any Senate campaign in history. I don't know what it will mean for his campaign. I think the primary is very long. I think, I think that every candidate will sort of have a moment, and you just kind of hope that your moment happens at the right time. But it's exciting to have a national audience that's interested to learn more about him, and I guess we'll see what the film means for his campaign, if anything.
David Modigliani is the director and producer of the documentary Running with Beto. It premieres on HBO on May 28th. David, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Just a real honor to be on. Really love your program, so thanks for having me.
Coming up, the lasting legacy of a classic song about California. The new documentary, Echo in the Canyon, looks at the folk rock music that came out of Laurel Canyon in the mid-1960s. And one defining song of the time was California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas. As Frame contributor Tim Grieving explains, it's a song that has transcended its era.
The best-known version of California Dreamin' is, without question, this one.
Stopped into a church, I passed along the way. Well, I got down on my knees.
No, wait, sorry, that's a 2004 cover by David Hasselhoff. The best-known version is this one. The song was written by then-married couple John Phillips and Michelle Phillips and was pretty transparently autobiographical.
Phillips wrote the song while he was living in New York and starving, and he had it in his pocket when he showed up in Los Angeles with the other singers who would be eventually the group Mamas and Papas.
Joel Selvin is an author and former pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He says, technically, the Mamas and the Papas weren't the first act to record California Dreamin'.
Barry McGuire had a number one hit, and he was in the studio to follow up that number one hit. Now, he was friends with John Phillips from in New York in the folk scene in Greenwich Village, and he brought in not only the song California Dreamin', but he convinced producer Lou Adler to let Phillips and his associates sing the background vocals on the session. They needed money. They were starving. And they came in and they sang the background vocals, and McGuire put a harmonica solo in the middle eight.
California Dreamin' on such a winter's day.
And Adler, it was his opinion that the background singers owned the record. Barry was like a special guest that didn't belong. So he wiped off Barry's vocal, added the vocal from Denny Doherty of the Mamas and Papas, and wiped off the harmonica solo, went down the hall where jazz musician Bud Shank was doing another session, and brought Shank in to put that flute solo on where the harmonica solo had been, and bingo, new record.
And the sky is gray.
Plenty of people went California Dreamin' after the song came out in 1966. 2 years later, the Puerto Rican artist Jose Feliciano released a cover with a decidedly Latin flair.
California Dreamin', dream on. Oye, mira, yo quiero gozar en California, porque yo me siento tan bien. Y por eso yo te quiero, porque tú me tratas bien. En California, mira, no se tan mala, nena.
Interestingly, the next three notable covers were by black artists. R&B legend Bobby Womack had a modest hit with the song in 1969, just a few years after the uprising in Watts, mere months after Robert F. Kennedy's assassination at LA's Ambassador Hotel, and right in the middle of the Zodiac Killer's reign of terror in Northern California. Womack's take leans into the song's underlying blues.
All the leaves are brown. And the sky is gray. I went for a walk.
The song, it comes completely from white culture. I mean, you know, people don't sit around up in Harlem dreaming of going to Watts, you know? It's not the same cultural axis at all. And Womack, I think, understood the irony. That's something that's operated in his career pretty extensively, of him, you know, taking on that subject matter.
And in 1977, Eddie Hazel, the lead guitarist for Parliament Funkadelic, did his own more syncopated, funky version of the song.
I stopped into a church that I passed along the way. Well, I had to get down on my knees.
And then this group had a hit with their cover in 1986.
The Beach Boys eventually did one in like the 80s, I think, that was really lame as hell. But again, they recognized in that song their own ethos.
The song continued to speak to new generations, literally, as Wilson Phillips, the group made up of Brian Wilson's daughters Carney and Wendy, and John and Michelle Phillips' daughter China, reinterpreted the song in 2012.
All the leaves are brown.
And in 2016, 50 years after the Mamas and the Papas hit the charts with California Dreamin', the song became a number one hit on the Billboard dance charts, with this cover by the German DJ Freischwimmer. Clearly, this is a song that translates across genres as well as generations. I asked Joel Selvin,
is the California paradise real? Well, It's based in reality, but believe me, you know, anxiety, frustration, melancholy, all those kind of things existed in California. They do not exist in the pop culture view of the California myth.
California Dreamin' for the Frame, I'm Tim Greaven.
All the leaves are brown.
This final version of California Dreamin' is by Queen Latifah. If you want to check out the documentary Echo in the Canyon, you can find it in select theaters. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
I'd be so safe and warm if I was in LA.